Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we'll explore what could become the world's largest trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and what it could mean for the countries that are considering signing on to it. Joining us are two experts. Raj Bala is the Rice Distinguished Professor and Dean for International and Comparative Law at the University of Kansas School of Law. He's the author of International Trade Law, Interdisciplinary Theory and Practice, Trade, Development, and Social Justice. Meredith Kalski Lewis is a professor at State University of New York's Buffalo Law School and at Victoria University. She is also co-editor of Trade Agreements at the Crossroads and International Economic Law and National Autonomy, and co-author of International Business Law. Welcome, Professor Meredith Kalski Lewis and Professor Raj Bala. It's great to have the two of you here on the Scholar's Circle. Maybe we should start with what exactly we're looking at with this TPP agreement, what it is, who's involved, and then we'll back up and get a little historic context for how we got to where we are. Meredith, is this something that you can start us with?
I'd be happy to. Thank you for inviting me to participate in the program today. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a free trade agreement currently under negotiation with 12 countries participating. The agreement began or arose out of an earlier free trade agreement, which consists of four countries, and that's New Zealand, Singapore, Chile, and Brunei. And those four countries formed a free trade agreement, which I'll call FTA for simplicity, formed an FTA in 2005, I believe it was. And their goal was to create an agreement that would serve as a model for a future agreement that could encompass a lot of countries from the Asia Pacific and possibly become a free trade agreement of the Asia Pacific, consisting of many of the APEC economies. That agreement, that precursor agreement of those four countries, was not comprehensive in that it only covered trade in goods and some services, but it didn't include trade in investment in the initial agreement. And the parties agreed that 2 years after that agreement came into effect, they would have further negotiations to add investment and financial services. At the time those negotiations began in around 2008, the U.S. took notice and said, we're potentially interested in joining your agreement. We'd like to sit in on your negotiations. And part of the methodology that the original four had in mind for acting as a model agreement was to provide that other countries could join with the permission of the initial four, which is not necessarily common in free trade agreements. So once the U.S. said it was interested, unsurprisingly, several other countries also expressed interest. And over a relatively short period of time, the U.S. indeed said it was interested and was quickly joined by Australia, Peru, Malaysia, and Vietnam. And then more recently, in 2012, Canada and Mexico joined the negotiations, and then Japan at the end of 2013, I believe it was. And that's where we are today.
So what have we gained in terms of knowledge? What have we learned from the predecessor to today? And maybe we should look back into earlier predecessors as well, other trade agreements. What are the pros? What are the cons? Raj Bala, what would you say?
Meredith gave a wonderful and comprehensive overview and explanation of that. Thank you. And thank you also for having me on. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. As Meredith said, the earlier agreement from the American perspective was, to use the American term, not ambitious. The U.S. prides itself in its FTA policy of having ambitious trade agreements. And what it means by that is that they are broad in scope. They cover all areas of the economy, goods and services. And there are no a priori exclusions. Very rarely, Korea and rice is a rare example, has the U.S. agreed to an exclusion. They cover all services on a negative list approach, meaning that all services are presumed to be covered unless specifically excluded. They cover government procurement, which is a very important area of the world economy, about 20% of output. So they're very broad in coverage. And the earlier predecessor agreement was not. Ambitious means deep as well as broad. And deep means the U.S. wants to eliminate difficult to find, difficult to root out, you know, non-transparent, behind-the-border measures. And these can be measures like unfair advantages from the U.S. perspective given to state-owned enterprises when they're competing in the private marketplace against private companies like post office, courier, insurance services. And they can include restrictions on pricing of services, goods, including IP. So ambitious means broad and deep, and the predecessor agreement was not. Now, Meredith said something else that was very, very important when she mentioned the year 2008. 2008 was when the Doha round produced of the WTO, the World Trade Organization's current round of multilateral trade negotiations. 2008 was in December, is when the WTO produced draft texts covering the major areas of negotiation, agriculture, industrial products, services, rules like anti-dumping and countervailing duties. And it was very clear in 2008 that the Doha round had ground to a halt. And some even said it was dead. And so the U.S. realized in 2008 that it was not going to be able to pursue its market access objectives through the Doha round anytime soon, if at all. So why not pivot to the second best solution, which of course is the FTA approach, and thus the U.S. entry into TPP. So, you know, that's another dimension to this history. And the U.S. was sort of rethinking its Asia Pacific strategy. And it thought that maybe the old agreement, the predecessor agreement, which you asked about, might be enlarged and used as a national security device to, if for lack of a better term, contain China.
That's fascinating in terms of using these trade agreements as not just about trade, but as a means to accomplish other things as well. What are the various motivations to doing this? Obviously, some countries like the U.S. want to secure better conditions for their companies and such. What are some of the other motivations? You mentioned the security one. What are some others?
Encouraging reform in countries, especially along the lines that the U.S. would favor, like a far greater and a more extensive protection of intellectual property rights, privatization of state-owned enterprises, possibly dealing with issues of investor state and dispute resolution, so that might help reform the way in which companies have to deal with not have to deal with local courts. In other words, encouraging reform in emerging economies. That's one motivation. Another motivation is locking in such reform. If they have occurred already, why not lock it in? In other words, if the country has, say, for example, Vietnam has entered into its domestic legal position is that it has implemented some reforms. But the U.S. is concerned that maybe one day different leadership might revoke some of those reforms. Well, why not lock them into an international agreement? Now, to give different sides to this, there are a number of critics that would say that an additional purpose is corporatist, that the idea that what's really going on here is advancing a corporate agenda that protects plutocratic interests.
So it would be considered in that criticism to be really anti-democratic.
That's right. And that's evidence from the lack of transparency, because as we know, the only texts that have been available have been available via WikiLeaks. Congressmen and congresswomen and senators, they can only view a text on a restricted basis, text of a chapter of TPP, by going to a specifically designated office, and they're not allowed to take their aides, and they're not allowed to take notes.
Can't take notes.
Right. No notes, no aides, staffers, nothing. You go in the room, you read, you know, presumably hundreds of pages that, you know, for any of us who are used to looking at these documents, much less a non-specialist, are very difficult to fathom.
Meredith, what would you add?
Well, I first of all want to quibble a little bit with Raj's characterization of the P4, the precursor agreement, as not having been ambitious. It's true that that agreement covered less territory than the TPP in its current form. However, the P4 countries sought to create a very, what I will call, clean agreement without a lot of exceptions. And while the U.S. is not too bad in terms of what it excludes from its FTAs, the U.S. often excludes sensitive agricultural products, textiles, and other items from its free trade agreements because it's politically difficult to liberalize trade in those areas. The P4 agreement had no exclusions for any goods at all. As incredibly unusual and made it a very comprehensive agreement in terms of liberalization for trade in goods. I agree with Raj that it did not have as wide a range of non-tariff behind the border types of chapters. However, some would argue that some of those types of provisions are not unequivocally or definitely trade promoting. So, for example, having very high intellectual property protections arguably may stifle trade in some ways. And so it's a different beast what we're dealing with today and what the original P4 parties envisioned. But I would quibble with the notion that that agreement was not ambitious. I think it actually was quite ambitious and novel for its time. The other thing I would just follow up on is Raj's comment about the strategic motivations for the U.S. to get involved. And while it's true that the collapse of Doha or the perceived collapse clearly led countries to turn more towards free trade agreements, in the case of the U.S. and the TPP, I don't think the original objective was primarily market access, but was more the geopolitical strategic potential of this agreement. Because if you think about the original four countries, the U.S. already had a free trade agreement with Singapore. It already had a free trade agreement with Chile. It had rejected New Zealand's overtures for a free trade agreement for about 25 years. And maybe it was Brunei, but I'm going to guess no on that. So the motivation was obviously what was the potential for this agreement to grow into? And as Raj indicated, the potential is that you get some big economies there. You expand into other areas of the Asia Pacific. You bring in countries that are worried about China's dominance, and you don't invite China to the table. And so now we have an agreement that encompasses close to 40% of world trade, including number one and number three economies, and China isn't there. So the U.S. has now put itself in a position where it is in the center of this possible Asia-Pacific-wide agreement, and it's setting the rules instead of standing on the outside. So strategically, it makes a lot of sense.
Meredith, I wonder if you would also respond to this concern about the sort of anti-democratic nature of the TPP and some of their predecessors. You know, my cursory understanding of these agreements, really dealt with local states being able to protect, say, their environment, protect public health, protect human rights, workers' rights, consumer rights in the ways that they thought were appropriate, and then potentially being overridden by the points within the agreement. How do you see it?
I think that the concerns about transparency with respect to this agreement can best be understood as arising out of the fact that this is a very big agreement, and most of the U.S.'s previous FTAs were with pretty small parties and had much more to do with rewarding an ally for joining with us in our military endeavors or being sympathetic to U.S. position towards Israel. And so we have FTAs with countries like Jordan and Morocco and small countries. And I don't think those negotiations were any more transparent than this one, but no one was paying attention because no one really cared that the U.S. was forming an FTA with Jordan. So to me, this is not particularly different or new or a more cloaked procedure than any other FTA, but it's a very important agreement, and so people are suddenly paying attention. I personally think that the administration has done a reasonable job of having public fora and getting information out there. I research in this area, and I find that I'm able to find information relatively easily. I have a pretty good idea what the issues are in the negotiations just from what's publicly reported. But the bottom line is, in any negotiation, the parties are not going to put their full positions out for public viewing because it ties your hands in terms of what you can do at the end game of the negotiation. So I'm not saying that there couldn't be more transparency, but I'm a little bit sympathetic to the positions of the governments because you really can't put everything out there or you're going to tie your hands.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing what could be the world's largest trade agreement to date, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and what it means for countries that may sign on to it. Stay tuned.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month. Dolores Huerta, Vice President of the National Farm Workers Union, discusses the California grape strike.
And I think that the hardest job that Caesar had, you know, in his dream when he first started to organize farm workers, was just getting them to understand that they could do something for themselves. But the important thing was to get people to have faith in themselves and to have faith in each other so that they could help each other in a union.
Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org.
Listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Raj Bala, can you perhaps respond to the concerns that have been raised by critics with regards to local protections, environment, human rights, labor, consumer, public health? Are these endangered by the TPP and other trade agreements?
Well, a lawyer wants to see the text of the law or the proposed text of the law to answer a question like that, which is a very reasonable one, with any degree of certainty. And so transparency is a serious concern. And I don't think the historical record shows that previous deals have been negotiated on par in terms of transparency as this one. Certainly not at the WTO level, and not most, if any, of the FTAs. Keep in mind that all previous FTAs were negotiated under Presidential Trade Promotion Authority, or Fast Track Authority, which expired on the 30th of June, 2007. And under those TPA or Fast Track rules, there were transparency or transparency-like provisions, which included disclosure and inclusion of disclosure of texts and inclusion of congressmen and senators and congresswomen on negotiating teams. In fact, you know, that's an interesting area of research, is exactly how much transparency is required under a fast track bill. I mean, you know, it's maybe of a bit of a U.S. constitutional point, but our Commerce Clause, Foreign Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, gives the power to negotiate foreign trade agreements to Congress, not the president. So it's actually the 435 members of the House and 100 senators that are involved in the negotiations. Now, because that's infeasible to have a crew of 535, they delegate that authority. And it understandably, the expertise rests with the USTR. But they are acting under the delegation of the People's House and of the Senate. And here, TPP has not been negotiated under that kind of delegated authority. So when you then ask the very understandable question about labor, environment, human rights, women's rights, intellectual property, it's difficult to give you a clear answer. I can certainly, as Meredith, I know, certainly can too, offer the perspectives that have been given by unions on the labor issue versus management on the labor issue, or likewise, NGOs like Sierra Club or Natural Resources Defense Council on environmental issues, and pharma versus generic producers on IP. But who's right? You know, until us lawyers see the text and see where are the ambiguities, what can be potentially exploited, I feel it's premature of me to come to a final, you know, resting point on it.
Meredith, how would you respond to that?
First, maybe it would be useful for your listeners if I just said a little bit more about Trade Promotion Authority, which Raj mentioned, because that's a really important concept that people might not be completely familiar with, and it's very relevant to what's going to happen next with the TPP. As Raj indicated, in the past, free trade agreements in the U.S. have pretty much always been negotiated when the president has trade promotion authority, or what we sometimes call fast track authority. And what that means is that USTR goes off, negotiates an agreement, and presents it to Congress for an up or down vote. They are not allowed to attach riders. They're not allowed to strike out provisions they don't like. They can't add in pet projects. And so that is really a big ask, to ask Congress to give that power to the president. However, in the absence of that power, it is very, very difficult, if not impossible, I would say pretty much impossible, for the executive to actually negotiate a trade agreement, because the other country is not going to be willing to make its best offer, knowing that whatever the U.S. has offered may be struck out, may be amended by Congress. And so that type of negotiation doesn't work. You have to both be able to offer your real offer and not be at risk of it being reneged by the other side. So at present, President Obama does not have fast track authority, and the negotiations have been sort of going on with the expectation that as the end game nears, Congress will give the president that authority. And in fact, there are discussions right now going on in Congress about just that. And apparently the one of the sticking points is the type of issues that you just raised, that people who are concerned about the content of the agreement would like to impose a lot of conditions on the granting of fast track authority to say, yes, we'll give it to you, but the end agreement must contain this, that, or the other, or we need to see such and such and such. And I think that the holdup is there's a concern on the side of USTR that some of the things that are being demanded are not feasible. They can't actually deliver them. So it's an open question right now when or if fast track authority will be granted. The Republicans in the main are supportive. Trade is a funny beast where Democrats tend to be somewhat more suspicious, but it's the president's party, and so he's getting more pushback from his own party than from the Republicans. But if there is no fast track authority, this deal is not going to close, is the most likely outcome.
Raj Bala, let's bring you back in. Something that you said very early on that I want to go back to, and I know I've gone back to it a couple of times, but you mentioned that there are multiple reasons to motivate agreements like this, including security issues. Could these types of FTAs, free trade agreements, be used to advance things like a climate policy or a more protective human rights policy? Or are they too skewed towards the corporate interests?
Yeah, absolutely. They could be used for a race to the top instead of a race to the bottom. For example, on climate change, if the schedules of tariff concessions under TPP were to provide for duty-free, quota-free treatment, what we call DFQF treatment, for all environmental goods. And of course, the countries would have to agree on what is an environmental good. But take a classic example like a solar panel or solar cell batteries. Those would have a lot lesser carbon footprint. So, and they're cleaner technology. So if those were traded within the TPP region without any tariffs or quotas, that would advance the battle against climate change. To use another example, which would come from the labor area, if the TPP labor chapter mandated the inclusion of all of the core labor rights that the International Labor Organization, the ILO, requires, and there are five of them, and they include like minimum age for workers, you know, no child labor, in other words, usually about age 14. They include the right to associate freely and to bargain collectively. So if those were included, and if there were credible dispute resolution mechanisms on labor issues, that would advance labor interests. I mean, take the example again of Vietnam. It is a one-party communist state, but conceivably the TPP labor provisions might call for independent trade unions. And of course, the government in Vietnam might be looking at those suspiciously, knowing the history of solidarity in Poland. But it's the kind of thing that might advance labor rights. I think also Meredith made another excellent point about TPA, which you might want to pick up on, and how difficult it is to negotiate without it, because the counterparty, the other country, is not going to lay down on the table its final offer. And I can use an example which sounds technical, but real people's lives are at stake. Two separate issues, which may seem unrelated, might get connected through a horizontal examination of the agreement. One of them is on intellectual property and the question of data exclusivity, whether or not data that was used to secure an initial patent for a pharmaceutical, for a medicine, can be used by a generic producer once that patent is expiring and the generic producer wants to then go ahead and produce it generically. The generic producer is going to need some regulatory approval. So it's going to be asked, well, what data do you have to show that this medicine that you're, that is now expired in terms of its patent would be safe if you produced it generically? The U.S. has, based on reports, has been calling for a data exclusivity period of upwards of 12 years. Now, that would be in addition to the U.S. position, as far as we know, of 25 years of patent protection. So 25 plus 12 means 37 years. Now, the WTO standard is 20 years. You would ask, you know, what's the point of some of these FTAs? What, still another logic to them is you can get WTO plus provisions. All right, so one question is data exclusivity. Now, the U.S. is going to push hard on a 12-year rule. Other countries have been reported to say we want only 5 years. That's the most we'll give you because, again, real lives are at stake. We want to get generic production out into the marketplace and reduce the cost of medicines for our people who do not have per capita incomes at American levels. Well, how do we know that the likes of, say, Malaysia are going to give their final offer of maybe 7 years or 5 years until they know what the U.S. is going to give as its final offer? And the U.S. isn't in a position yet without trade promotion authority. A similar example can be made on another technical area of what are called rules of origin. The Vietnamese want to include Chinese cotton in their textile and apparel production that would count for duty-free, quota-free treatment. The American side says, no, not Chinese cotton. China's not a player in TPP. That's not going to count as made in Vietnam. Well, what's the final rule of origin that the two sides are going to settle on? Will Vietnam agree to excluding Chinese cotton or not? Again, we don't know until the U.S. has that firm, credible negotiating position that Meredith talked about with TPA.
Meredith, anything you'd like to respond to that? And also, in terms of state-to-state relations, like U.S.-China, what are the effects of this, particularly the TPP, but other trade agreements as well?
Well, before I get to that question, why don't I just go back and touch on something that Raj was fleshing out, which is just to note that from the U.S. perspective, the U.S. tends to push for things in its free trade agreements that it couldn't get all of the WTO members to agree to in the context of the Doha round or any other WTO round. So some of the issues you raise, such as labor rights, environmental protection, some of those things, factions within Congress insist on being part of U.S. trade agreements, and they are, but they get into U.S. trade agreements because the U.S. has so much more bargaining power in negotiating one-on-one with a relatively small trading partner. And it doesn't have that bargaining power in the WTO, where it's consensus-based and you have over 100 developing countries participating who are not interested in heightened labor protections or heightened environmental protections. So the U.S. uses its bargaining power to its advantage. But certainly different people would have differing views over whether the U.S. is emphasizing the right things in terms of what it pushes for. So people who are concerned about labor rights will like the labor chapter, but people who think that pharmaceuticals should be cheaper are really going to dislike the intellectual property chapter. So I just wanted to follow up on that point. In terms of country-to-country relations, you know, in the past, free trade agreements really were largely about, they were about market access to some degree, but mainly you had big countries entering into deals with small countries or neighbors entering into deals with each other. And we had no negotiations, none, between any two of the big economies. So until 3 years ago, no negotiations between the EU and the US. The EU and Japan, the EU and China, US and Japan, down the list. Now we have the US negotiating a free trade agreement with Japan via the TPP, US negotiating an FTA with Europe via the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, You have China, Japan, and Korea all negotiating with each other in an agreement called RCEP in Asia. So we have a very different dynamic going on today where several FTAs are under negotiation, each of which will comprise 35% or more of world GDP. So there's an old saying that countries that trade with each other don't go to war with each other. And that's sort of mild historical interest when you have FTAs with very small countries. But when you're entering into FTAs with your very major other economies, that becomes, those partnerships are of major significance strategically and politically, as well as economically, because having access to the Japanese market is a big deal for the U.S. Having access to the European market, preferential access, is a big deal. But the political linkages are also very important.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. When we come back, can trade agreements such as the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership be made to be humanitarian, democratic, and transparent? Up next, stay tuned.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month. Poet Sylvia Plath with excerpts from a 1962 radio interview.
These peculiar, private, and taboo subjects, I feel, have been explored in recent American poetry. I think particularly of the poetess Anne Sexton, who writes also about her experiences as a mother who's had a nervous breakdown, as an extremely emotional and feeling young woman. And her poems are wonderfully craftsmanlike poems, and yet they have a kind of emotional and psychological depth, which I think is something perhaps quite new, quite exciting.
Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org.
Hi, dunia. Ye dunia badi gol hai. Hi, dunia. इसमें कितने झोल गलियों गलियों चप्पा चप्पा अबलम चप्पलम लारे लप्पा तोबा तोबा रब्बा रब्बा जी 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 तोला पल में मासा पल में छोड़ा पल में फासा अगड़ में देख तमाशा जी 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 आई दुनिया ये दुनिया बड़ी गो
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. You talked about something I was going to bring up, which is this idea. I mean, the whole idea behind the European Union, at least in a big way, was that the more you link them together economically, the less likely you have major violent conflict between them. But at the same time, I wonder then if you are also creating a sort of permanent underclass, permanently marginalized people, if, in fact, this is doing the corporate thing that Raj Bala was talking about, where the major players have major benefits, and yet the other players, the people who may have been marginalized in the past, may or may not be able to get a foothold because their own countries, their own states, are hamstrung by the agreements. Raj Bala, am I on track? Am I off track?
I think you're right on track. You're absolutely right on track. The vision that trade would help integrate previously conflicting countries is a long-held vision and a mainstay of U.S. trade policy. It originates as early as 1933 when President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, took office, and his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, who's actually our longest serving Secretary of State, embodied that vision and went around under a 1934 act that Congress delegated authority to him to reduce trade barriers that had been put up during the Great Depression. Now, it didn't prevent the Second World War, obviously, and that's one of the weaknesses in the peace through trade argument, and that is that there is a different ideology, a radical ideology that puts something else above trade and the gains from trade, means that the peace through trade idea doesn't matter. It's not as important. Now, in those days, we saw the history showed that it was fascist and Nazi ideology. Today, it's extremism in the misname, because it's not the true name, in the misname of Islam. Nothing, no free trade agreement is going to make Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Boko Haram, Jihadi Islami, none of those, if I may say, monstrous evildoers are going to lay down their arms and start trading because they do not think trade is more important than their radical ideology. So they're not part of this peace through trade. You're absolutely right on track, because you also identified a second category of people who have hope in the trading system. They're not influenced yet by radical or extremist ideology. They are in the lower middle class or middle class. They may want to engage in imports, exports. They want to develop a small and medium-sized enterprise, an SME. And for them, trade might well be an opportunity. You can think, for example, of immigrant families into the United States that set up a business, incorporate in the United States, set up a business, and then that business expands from the locality to the region, and then ultimately importing or exporting back to their home country. Say, to take advantage, if they came from Central America, they take advantage of CAFTA. CAFTA DR, which is an FTA with the Central American countries and Dominican Republic. For them, the peace through trade vision does give hope. And the concern is, which is exactly right that you expressed it, is if the FTA is indeed, and that's an if it is a corporate overreach, if it is doing nothing more than advancing corporate interests, if it is solidifying the distribution of wealth in the world, that's 1% controlling 50% of the world's assets, then that second group that looks to these agreements to benefit from them gets frozen out. They don't see the gains from it. They focus more on the job losses. They focus more on the risks than on the opportunities. And then the risk is that the two groups merge. That is to say, not that everyone turns and joins Al-Qaeda, not that, but the second group, the people who wanted to benefit from trade, instead feel marginalized by it and they become more susceptible to extremist ideologies.
Or get left out of an economy that works for the way they may have previously worked. That's what I was talking about, maybe creating a permanent underclass, people who are not necessarily adept at working through that sort of neoliberal economy. I'm a political scientist. You're both law professors. So one of the things that I also think about is the proliferation of norms and how the economic systems interact with political systems. And so I've been thinking a lot about the proliferation of a neoliberal ideology as being now growing potentially through the trade agreements to a point where it becomes a global, like there are no alternatives to the neoliberal way of doing politics as well as the economy. It overrides the politics in some ways. Raj Bala, why don't you respond to that and we'll pass it back to Meredith.
It makes perfect sense. And I think one way, and this is a problem that we're seeing in TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, where, as you said, that the FTA, and still another purpose, going back to your first question, an FTA can be a means to proliferate norms. And the norms can include, of course, regulatory standards. And with TTIP, we're seeing a potential clash of cultures between the U.S. and EU on food safety. For example, the amount of genetically modified content that is acceptable in foods. We're also seeing a potential clash of cultures on investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms, and a third one on data privacy. And the U.S. would like to have the EU, in an ideal world, simply accept U.S. regulatory standards from the FDA or whatever relevant agency it is. That's not likely to happen in the EU. Now, you can look to other agreements, and Meredith mentioned RCEP, which is a fascinating one to study. And we might, if we get the chance, talk about India's role in RCEP vis-a-vis TPP. You can look at the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is a customs union. And I wouldn't describe those agreements as pushing hard the neoliberal, for lack of a better term, Washington consensus model. They're a go slower approach, and they look a lot at their own local and regional cultures. So it's not inevitable that the U.S. model of FTA that is, as you say, much more neoliberal is the one that everyone's adhering to.
Meredith Lewis, how would you respond?
Well, I think that both of you have touched upon what I think is one of the really concerning implications of the current crop of FTAs, which is that there is a definite potential for the rules that are established in these FTAs, because they involve large players, to then be multilateralized. So we have a negotiation between the U.S. and 11 other countries in the TPP, and we have the negotiation between the U.S. and the EU. If regulatory standards or other rules are established in these agreements, each of which will comprise 35%+ of world GDP, the members will then go off and form FTAs with other countries and insist on those norms in those agreements, and the result will be quite possibly that those become the de facto multilateral norms, but the poorer members of the WTO didn't get to have any say in setting them. And so that we may find that quite a lot of norms are now going to be established in FTAs and then will become the multilateral norms, but completely outside the process that gives the poorer countries that Raj alluded to and that you were concerned about, the voice that they're entitled to under that agreement.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing what could be the world's largest trade agreement to date, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and what it means for countries that may sign on to it. So where do we see this going from here? Raj Bala, where this seems to be going with the TPP, but also with some of the others?
That's a great and almost unanswerable question, because it involves, you know, some special insights into what's going on in Capitol Hill, which I wouldn't presume to have. And there's some variables at play that have not yet been, their values haven't been determined. For example, currency manipulation. There are a lot of people in Congress who would like to see in Trans-Pacific Partnership provisions against currency manipulation. There are also others who say, how do you differentiate that from monetary, legitimate monetary policy? Then there are a lot of concerns in Congress from senators like Warren and Brown about the ISDS provisions. And they're watching closely the Australian plain packaging case.
Could you say what ISDS?
Investor-state dispute settlement. Sure, I'm sorry. Investor-state dispute settlement mechanism, which is basically a mechanism under the FTA that allows for a case to be brought outside of the local courts. So that's what happened to Australia against Philip Morris in the case Philip Morris brought against Australia in the plain packaging of cigarettes. And it allowed Philip Morris to challenge the plain packaging rules that Australia has under a 2011 Act in the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, and it bypasses Australian courts. And more pro-consumer-oriented groups look at that case in horror and say it'll be too easy for corporations to challenge a legitimate regulatory initiatives. So, you know, your large question is what's going to happen with TPP? Let me try and answer it this way. First, we've got some big unresolved issues like currency manipulation and ideas. The second, and I'm speaking, you know, from my personal opinion, is it's not just the United States, just the USTR, but other countries as well. As I read the press releases, have consistently overstated how close they are to a final deal, consistently overstated how closed textual provisions are. And we don't know because we can't see the square bracketed text that is characteristic of the trade agreements. And have at the same time have missed every single deadline they've set. Now, the latest we heard was that the deal was imminent, that it would be done within a couple of weeks. And that was shortly after the president's State of the Union address. And I don't see any sense that we're that close to a deal yet. It's also not clear that the deal, whatever it is, would pass for the reasons, you know, Meredith and you mentioned about trade promotion authority. Would Congress have to pass a TPA retroactively? We don't know. The most optimistic scenario to try and give you kind of a one-liner is that TPA, the promotion authority, would be concluded first sometime this spring or early the summer. And the FTA itself, TPP, would be concluded later in the summer or early fall before the November election season really gets underway. If that doesn't happen, then this deal is not likely to go through during the presidential election cycle.
Meredith Lewis.
I agree completely with Raj about the timing. If TPA does not get granted in the next several weeks, the potential for the deal to be done before the next, you know, before 2017 is unlikely, because it's very politically sensitive topic, and no one running for president is going to want to touch it. And so it either needs to be finished well before the election cycle begins, or it will be deferred again. I completely agree with that.
Is there a very big difference between, say, how a Democratic president like Barack Obama would negotiate this versus, say, a Republican president might come in and negotiate a trade agreement like this? Have there been historic big differences like that, Raj Bala?
You know, I think I have to answer that. I don't know. I need to do more research on that. For most of the Second World War era, post-Second World War era, there had been a bipartisan consensus in favor of trade liberalization. So we really didn't differentiate too much President Kennedy's trade policies from President Nixon's, even though there were technical differences and some methodological differences. But there was generally a bipartisan consensus in favor of, let's say, at least freer trade. That broke down during the Clinton administration with controversies over labor and environment and NAFTA. And so the relevant time period to analyze your question would be really to consider the administration of George W. Bush vis-a-vis that of Barack Obama, and think and look carefully at what their strategies and tactics were. And I confess I've not done enough of that research. I would say that one difference has been that President Bush had a vision of a Middle East free trade agreement, a MEFTA. That has all been lost with the current administration. There's some talk of, you know, promoting qualified industrial zones, and that's been done to some degree in the Obama administration. But the idea of linking the Middle East in a network of FTAs that would promote free trade and democracy, that's a clear difference between the two administrations.
And Meredith Lewis.
Well, in terms of the different approaches of different administrations, I think it probably comes down more to the makeup of the Congresses that the presidents have to work with. So just in terms of the TPP, it was the Bush administration that initially expressed interest in seeing what was going on with the precursor agreement, the P4. And then when the Obama administration came in, they said, we need to review trade policy to decide what we want to do. And they decided to proceed with it as well. So there was no change. However, it was under the Bush administration. Bush had a Democratic Congress that insisted on trade agreements containing certain threshold levels of labor and environmental protections. And a deal was struck between Congress and the White House that all future FTAs would meet these thresholds. I think it's called the May 10th Agreement or something like that. And so that led to the negotiations that occurred under the Bush administration, including some of those provisions. Perhaps Bush himself wouldn't have made those issues his own priorities, but Congress insisted on it. The flip side is now Obama has a Republican Congress that is trying its best to give him trade promotion authority over the objections of his own party. So Congress plays a big role in this.
All right. Thank you, both of you. Raj Bala and Meredith Kalski-Lewis, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for having
thank
us.
Thank you.
Raj Bala is the Rice Distinguished Professor and Dean for International and Comparative Law at the University of Kansas School of Law. He's the author of International Trade Law, Interdisciplinary Theory and Practice, Trade Development and Social Justice. Meredith Kalski-Lewis is a professor at State University of New York's Buffalo Law School and at Victoria University. She is also co-editor of Trade Agreements at the Crossroads and International Economic Law and National Autonomy, and co-author of International Business Law. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprin, Ankine Agassian, and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month. Flora Moulton, blind street singer from Washington, D.C., talks about her music and sings, "I Can't Stand It," from this 1976 WPFW interview.
I wrote this song one night. Now, I'm going to tell you something about that, my songs that I write. I write songs about myself, and I write songs about history of things then. I can't stand it. I can't stand it.
This recording is part of American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publication and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org.